Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. Today, I am your only host, Zach Smarin. Just a quick intro, I'm talking to Steve Ogin, one of the leading Yiddishist organizers in Britain. We've known each other for a while, and I could not think of a better person to speak to on this subject that we have surprisingly not yet dedicated a full episode to. Also, we were together for the most recent Yiddishist Sofvoch, which took place last month. As regards the podcast, we're all very busy, but rest assured, we are not going anywhere. Our slight delays are only temporary. You know the drill. Like, rate, follow, subscribe, Patreon. Love you all. See you soon. Brüder und Schwestern von Arbeit und Neut, alle, was seinen zu seht und zu spreit, zusammen, zusammen, die von sie ist greit, sie flattert von Zorn, von Blut ist sie reut, a Schwue, a Schwue, a Fleb und Teut. Steve Schmulabel, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on. And would you like to tell us just a little bit about yourself to begin with?
Well, first of all, thanks very much, Zach, for the invitation. Not every day I speak on a podcast. In fact, I think this is the very first one I've ever spoken on.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. On a podcast, yeah.
People have been missing out in that case.
I've clearly been missing out, though I do listen to a lot of them. I'm originally from Liverpool, so I was born and bred in Liverpool, where I spent my early years going to the two Jewish schools in Liverpool. Then I went to Manchester University, went to work in industry, then went to Cambridge to do a PhD, and after that went to the University of Surrey, where I've taught in an engineering department for 37 years and retired in the middle of COVID from that. In terms of the Yiddish stuff, of course, that started with your, I don't want to embarrass you, but that began with your dad in the early 1980s.
I'm getting used to this at this stage. This isn't the first time that my dad comes up on the podcast. Hi, Dad. You'll probably listen to this one as well. So, my dad.
Yeah, well, your dad, Barry Smarin, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, what about him?
Well, we were both involved in an anti-racist organization in the early 1980s. It was the Anti-Nazi League, wasn't it? And I don't know how I found out that he is an excellent singer, and he sang, and he still does sing, Yiddish songs. And so he taught me Yiddish songs. He was probably my first Yiddish teacher from that perspective from the early 1980s. So there you go. So I maintained an interest in Yiddish for a very many years. I went to the Friends of Yiddish in Toynbee Hall, which was organized by Stenzel. Actually, I met Stenzel. Your dad introduced me to Stenzel, and I went to a party. I don't know which birthday it was of Stenzel's, and he taught me my first Yiddish sentence, which I said to Stenzel. I think he was a bit amused. I think I said to him, "Afage nigen eich zu kennen," or something like that. I said to him, and that was all I. Which a pleasure to meet you. I struggle to say that much, but I maintained an interest in Yiddish, and actually, I came across it again through the Yiddish Theatre, who were invited to Liverpool, and I came across the Yiddish Theatre in that point.
There was a Yiddish theatre in Liverpool?
No, it was the based in London. It was Anna Zelnicker, Harry Ariel, Benjamin Mendelovich. They'd lost their actual theatre space quite a few years before, but they toured the provinces, took Yiddish theatre to Liverpool. I think they went to Manchester, Leeds, wherever they were invited. And at that point, there were eight in the troupe, and my dad was chair of the Association of Jewish Ex-Servicemen in Liverpool, and he invited them to perform in Liverpool, and they performed in my old school, the King David High School, and I because he'd invited them, I thought I'd go along and support. And I thought, who on earth is going to want to see, what is this Yiddish theatre? Who knows anything about Yiddish? I hadn't heard anything about Yiddish. I'd been to the primary school in Liverpool and the high school. And for 13 years, I'd not heard a word about Yiddish in the two Jewish school in Liverpool. Who knows anything about Yiddish? So when I turned up that evening, the place was packed, absolutely packed. What was worse, they all understood the jokes. It was full of jokes. I understood absolutely nothing, but they were all of a certain age. They were all my parents' generation and an older generation, and literally the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, they were all there. So Tiffenberg, the butcher, was there. Chalkins was there. The baker, they were all there. And there was nobody of my age. And I thought, this is really, really mysterious. What's going on here? So that also kindled an interest in Yiddish. I thought, what is this?
That's a very interesting divide. What year was this?
That was 85, I think. Mm-hmm. And of course, I had been introduced to Yiddish song by your dad by that point. But Yiddish theatre, and, you know, this was a novelty to me.
Yeah. I mean, there certainly are some remains of Yiddish theatre that still exist. Quite recently, I think, in JW3, there was a few performances, or at least scenes that...
We organized that.
Yeah, exactly. So the Yiddish world is quite small, as it turns out, when most people do know each other. But even the state of Jewish theatre in general in Britain is not one that is much thought about at this stage. I don't know if the theatre in Hampstead still stands, but its fate has been quite uncertain. So why, at this stage, you've been involved with Yiddish for many years, and what sort of value has it given to you as not only just a medium, because every language ultimately is some kind of medium, but what does Yiddish mean to you personally as in its unique forms of expression, maybe less unique forms that you think necessitates nurturing and finding people to speak it and perhaps encouraging people to speak it? Why Yiddish?
Well, I think everybody finds their own route to Yiddish in their own way and at their own particular time of life when they become interested in it. I mean, I had a period to begin with when I was interested in Yiddish song, and then, you know, you get involved in other things in life. And although it was there in the background, I wasn't particularly interested. And then I came back to it. Everybody finds their own route to it. And I think for me, it provides a rootedness, I suppose, which is a fairly obvious thing. But I've always thought of the diagram, one way of thinking of relationship to Jewish culture and the Jewish community as sort of three big circles, and they can be overlapping. And one is obviously the area of religion. And you can relate to Jewish culture and civilization through religion. One is obviously through Israel, which is Israel-related stuff, which a lot of people relate to the Jewishness through that aspect, and those two circles can overlap. If your focus is neither of those things, if you're an atheist and if you're not that absorbed in Israel and it to that extent, then, you know, it's nice to have another circle. And for me, that circle is Yiddish and aspects of Yiddish culture. And obviously that can also overlap with the other two circles or not. And so I think it provides for me and probably for many people a way to express Jewishness, which doesn't necessarily have to flow through the other domains and is a domain in itself. Not excluding the other domains, because obviously for some people all three overlap, two of them overlap, but, you know, it provides another big domain. There is such a wealth of Yiddish culture stretching back centuries. Of course, Yiddish as a language developing in the 10th, 11th century, maybe earlier than that in the Rhinelands, and then the development of Yiddish writing and, you know, the development subsequently of more secular Yiddish writing. There's a whole I mean, the discoveries that are being made of historical Yiddish documents and then coming through to the Yiddish writers of the 18th, 19th centuries. And then, of course, we've got the great flowering of Yiddish at the secular Yiddish writing, the late 19th century and the early 20th century and going through the 20th century. I mean, it is just, it opens up so much in the way of understanding Jewish history and civilization. I mean, admittedly, in an Ashkenazi context, and the wonderful thing, I think, about most of the Yiddish world is that it recognizes the equal validity of other Jewish languages. Because once you recognize that there's more than one Jewish language, you can't really exclude, you know, you include all of them, even if you don't, you know, you don't find the time to get involved in them. And you're excited by the fact that now Ladino is having a renaissance, which is just absolutely wonderful, and other Jewish languages as well. So it provides another rootedness of Jewishness and a way to express that creatively and in putting things into a historical context.
Before we move on to talking about ideas of revival and other Jewish languages as well, I wanted to really touch a little bit on these three areas that you outline about religion, Israel, and Yiddish-related culture. Of course, there are many different overlaps that exist within them. One of the main ones that comes to mind when it is that the largest, by far, the largest community of Yiddish speakers and native speakers today are Hasidic Jews, many of whom, of course, live in Israel. But one thing that also comes to mind to me regarding Israel is that there was a discussion about this, I think, in the Yiddish Book Center in Boston, about Yiddish in Palestine, specifically with Jewish migration and their also religious Jewish migration in the 19th century, that Yiddish became quite a commonly spoken language in Palestine before Hebrew as such, and such could be also considered a native language in that sense. I didn't actually attend that talk as much as it piqued my interest. But I do think as well that these areas should not be seen as mutually exclusive and very much connected to each other, because that secular demographic of people that are interested in Yiddish as a means of culture and Jewish identity should, at least this is, I think, the most common idea in these circles, should be able to interact with native Yiddish speakers. And what that sometimes entails is, maybe not confusion, but differences in terms of language, for example. Not all forms of Yiddish are the same. And so I'll get, of course, to how things have been turning out recently in the Sofvoch, which are very interesting in that regard, and other initiatives. But in your earliest stages of being interested in Yiddish, was that aspect one that also came to mind, the fact that it is associated in England? If you do want to go to a place where you speak Yiddish, you go to Stamford Hill.
Actually, no, because not knowing much about the Yiddish world anyway at that point, I didn't even realise there was a very large Yiddish-speaking community in North London, who obviously are also, you know, they're quite inward-looking and quite isolated, and they don't really extend. It's not easy to come across them. Unless you live geographically close, I think, or unless you're looking to wander around. I mean, even wandering around Stamford Hill, which is an interesting thing to do, there's nowhere to go and meet people. I mean, the only real place is a couple of big bagel cafes and patisseries, delicatessen.
But the best place.
But even then, people are not that willing, I find. The only spaces I've actually had conversations with people in the bookshops when I was looking for books, and there it's quite good. You can go in and ask, you know, have you got this book, have you got that book? Then you might strike up a conversation with people. But no, I didn't know. And it's wonderful to discover this. And I didn't realize how many Yiddish speakers are there, 600,000, 700,000? I don't know. The figure is very large around the world.
And growing,
yeah. And, I mean, for example, you wander around B'nai Brak, which I did because I've often been to Israel over the last few years for the Yiddish summer program at Tel Aviv University. I would normally be there now, except they're not running the program this year for obvious reasons. And I tried to speak Yiddish with people and go up on, you know, say to them, Good Shabbos on a Friday evening, walking through, and they'd say to me, Shabbat Shalom. Because an awful lot of people in B'nai Brak actually speak Hebrew, and you have to actually know where to go to come across the Yiddish speakers. So it's quite fun. It's not the same in Jerusalem, not in the same extent, but it
that
is.
Reminds me,
B'nai
that reminds
me. In Tel Aviv.
That reminds me of something that my rabbi said quite a few years ago in Krakow, which irritated my father slightly. She said that, you know, back in the day, you know, the Jews would wander around these streets and on a Friday evening they would say to each other, Shabbat Shalom. And of course, he is the big Yiddishist, you know, he's rolled his eyes internally. Oh, yeah, that's what they were saying. They were saying Shabbat Shalom. Well, it turns out, at least in some from communities that do still speak Yiddish, that is something that you say today, you know, Shabbat Shalom, Good Shabbos. In terms of that ease of communication or lack thereof, I've had mixed experiences of that, because on one hand, I have heard either from my father or from my uncle, who also knows a little bit of Yiddish, the lack of interest or even opposition to seeing people who from Haredi Jews who see non-Haredi Jews off the derech, off the path, who do speak Yiddish, and a sort of hostility that's not something that only they, that only, well, not belongs to them, that's very materialistic, but only like the language that belongs in their community, in the same way that some Jews that are not religious might be treated in a more condescending way than religious people from other faiths in certain contexts. That's, of course, a little bit different when you come to people from Chabad, who are always very friendly to Jews who are not their own kind, so to speak. On the other hand, I had one particular situation. I haven't said this before on the podcast, but I was walking down Shiroka Street, which is the main street in the Jewish quarter in Kazimierz and Krakow today, during Pesach. And in a place where there was a former restaurant, there used to be a restaurant open for everyone. And then for the last 2-3 years, it has become a Haredi Jewish place. But I'd never been inside there. The curtains are sort of made white. You can't see anything from the outside. And just on one occasion, this was during during Pesach, and it was also Shabbos, we walked past there and there were some people just standing outside. One of them just sort of nodded at me. I was wearing a kippah, you know. And at some point, you know, we just managed to have a conversation in English. He was from Stamford Hill. But this was not Chabad or anything like that. But he just invited us inside, me and Idol. And suddenly we found ourselves in a place. What this place was used for at this moment was Haredi Jewish families that sell their houses for Pesach, meaning that, you know, so that they don't have to clean and remove chametz. And my Yiddish, as sort of maybe not beginner, but certainly not more than intermediate, was a big object of fascination, and not in a sort of condescending way, but people being interested in it. Of course, it was called very German, because if I do speak Yiddish, it will be more Klal or Litvish connected, while most Haredi Jews speak other varieties. But it was nevertheless very welcoming. So I think it's certainly as a form of a connection between traditional or Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox. I know some don't like that word, and secular Yiddishists. I think that's certainly a possibility of connecting in that way. And when it comes to that, I think this is a good point that we should speak a little bit about the open mic and the Sofvach. So you're one of the people that started the Yiddish open mic. Could you just tell us a little bit about how it started and also just what the format is? Because I think the format is, pardon me for waxing lyrical a little bit, but I think the format is so simple, but clever and useful for what it tries to accomplish, that it's really something that, and universal in the sense that it can be emulated wherever people want to organize such an event around the world, really, in person or online or mixed. So with that out of the way, with my sort of complimenting out of the way, could you tell me a little bit about the story of the Yiddish Open Mic Cafe? And then we can talk a bit about the Sofoch as well.
Oh, yeah, sure. I don't know how far back you want me to go with that. But actually, the origin of the Yiddish Open Mic is the London Yiddish Ukulele Group.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because I was singing Yiddish songs unaccompanied, and a friend of mine had written a book about playing the ukulele and singing songs, and I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I'll try and accompany myself on the ukulele singing Yiddish songs, and I had a go at doing that. And then I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun to do that with other people? Because ukulele groups are very well known as, basically, a ukulele group is an excuse for people to sing together and accompany themselves at a basic level on the ukulele. I put out a call on Facebook for people to come and play Yiddish songs, and I got 10 likes, and I booked a basement of a pub in central London, and basically nobody turned up. Well, no, that's not true. Nobody turned up for for an hour or so, and a couple of people turned up. And from that, we grew it to about 8 people singing Yiddish songs and playing the ukulele. There were only 2 of the 8 who actually know Yiddish, and me and one of the others, but the others were happy to learn the words and sing, but they were better ukulele players than we were. So the London Yiddish Ukulele Group was born, and then the question was, where was it going to play? Now, I'd had experience of, I used to sing, my brother used to accompany me on piano, I used to sing Yiddish songs in Jewish care homes, and had a wonderful experience at a Jewish care home in North London when my brother and I were setting up we were setting up the piano and stuff and getting ready before everybody arrived. There were 2 guys waiting there for us. One of the guys in the Jewish care home said to the other one, he said, "Well, I wonder if they're any good." And the second one said, "Well, if they're any good, they wouldn't be here."
Ooh.
Which I thought was very pointed and very funny. So I didn't think that was necessarily where we wanted to start the career of the London Yiddish Ukulele Group. So where do you play? Well, Mark Wallington, who was the guy who wrote the book about playing the ukulele, he'd gone round England playing at open mics. And a lot of people play ukulele at open mics. I thought, this is a great idea. Why don't we try and have a Yiddish open mic, because that will provide a home for the London Yiddish Ukulele Group to play. But I couldn't possibly do that by myself because nobody knew me, and probably still don't. But they do know Vivi Lax, who has several klezmer groups and is a writer and a performer and very well known around London. And an old, she's also from Liverpool, though, a bit younger than me. We weren't in the same class. So I found out where Vivi was performing and went down to see her. She was at the Surrey Reform Synagogue doing a performance. And I saw at the interval, I said, "Vivi, I've got this crazy idea. What about a Yiddish open mic?" And she's really liked the idea. And she said, "Well, let's include somebody who's very well connected, especially amongst younger people, and that's Rachel Weston." So me, Rachel Weston, and Vivi Lax, the 3 of us, launched the Yiddish Open Mic Cafe in April 2018. We were very lucky that a famous Yiddish actor called Shane Baker was in London at the time. And we did it at the Book the Space in the Poetry Cafe, that's the National Poetry Cafe. For the Poetry Society of the United Kingdom, they have a cafe called the Poetry Cafe in Covent Garden. And they have a space for book launches in the basement. So we booked the space in the basement and 60 people turned up. It was absolutely fantastic.
For those outside of Britain or maybe even outside of London, Covent Garden is the place for the best British artists, at least for those performing outside. You need to get a special license. Ed Sheeran was there. You walk up there, there's people juggling on unicycles, stuff like that. So in that kind of environment, only the best sort of artists could begin performance. I also wanted to say the story about the ukulele players and the Yiddish speakers. It reminded me of the Polish expression of the blind man carrying a cripple and the cripple telling him where to go. Just sort of two groups of different abilities being able to help each other out in that situation. So you started off in April 2018, and how has the Yiddish Open Mic continued since then? What's the format?
Well, we didn't have the current format then. In fact, we were very rigid to begin with, and we said everything's got to be in Yiddish, just Yiddish. And so the 60 had dwindled to about 10. After the first 3 months, it was once a month. And then I said to Vivi, this is not going to work. We've got to include some English. So that's when we came up with the idea of projecting the Yiddish and the English onto the screen so everybody could read the Yiddish. They could read the Yiddish, they could concentrate on that. But they had an English translation as well. So your Yiddish didn't need to be great or even reasonably good to understand what was going on. And even somebody with reasonable Yiddish, if you come across a poem, the language is usually so complicated, at least it is for me, that I need a translation. We would do that. We'd ask people to send the Yiddish with an English translation. I put together the presentation, which is a PowerPoint presentation. We typically have 4, 5, or 6 performances, no longer than 8 to 10 minutes in the first half. We'd break for coffee because it's a lovely cafe upstairs, and nobody would ever get back in time for the second half, but then we'd have the same thing in the second half. And, you know, there was communal singing, there were songs everybody knew. We started to do a bit of theatre, so there was poetry, there was songs, there was a bit of theatre, and it worked very well. And we also branched out. We wanted to reach other audiences a bit. We went to the London Jewish Museum, which has a bigger space. We did a bigger bits of theatre there. And we had some children performing as well, which was lovely. And all that was great up until COVID hit in 2020. And, well, obviously we couldn't carry on. And so Zoom was new. Nobody really tested out Zoom at that point, but we thought, well, we'll switch to Zoom. And we moved the whole thing onto Zoom. And that suddenly gave us an international audience and international performers. And now we had an audience from literally around the world. We had audiences of typically in the COVID period between 60 and 80. We had performances from Poland, from around Europe, from North and South America, even from Australia. People stayed up to the small hours to contribute. We did large ghetto commemorations, which went on way too long, but were very important, we felt. And we have very large audiences for the COVID period. And once restrictions were lifted, the open mic online carried on, but the audience numbers reduced. And now it's typically about 30 to 40. Something like that, but still with an audience from around the world. Or Israel, Canada, Latin America, etc., all sorts of places, and performers as well, regular performers. A regular performer is Daniel Galai from the Yiddish Publishing House in Tel Aviv, based Levick, for example, and Daniel writes plays, and they're often performed for the first time on the open mic, Yiddish plays. So it's carried on in that form roughly once a month. It's now led by 3 other people, though I'm also involved in organizing, but we now have 3 other people who lead the open mic. Mindy Lieberman from California, Barbara Bortz, and Barry Berland from the UK. And we felt it was important to try to do face-to-face things as well, again, with the open mic. So we had a partnership with the big Jewish community center in North London called JW3. And we, 3 times a year, we've done live performances of the open mic at JW3. But I think we're going to move to other venues as well now. So, yeah, so it's now both online and face-to-face.
Yes, and so how many open mics does that mean at this point?
Oh, God, I've lost track. I think it's 65 now, we're up to 65, 66, wow. Something like that. There's a lot of them because they are on Zoom, are recorded, and we put the recordings onto Zoom on our Yiddish Open Mic Cafe YouTube channel. If anybody wants to catch up with hours and hours of Yiddish Open Mic Cafe, mm-hmm. It's on the YouTube channel.
We will add a link to the description of the on YouTube and the show notes, but take it from a podcast co-host that tries to have an hour-long podcast published every 2 weeks. That is a lot of dedication and time.
Yeah, and I used to only lightly edit, because on the Zoom recordings, as you well know, there's an awful lot of things that it would be nice not to be there. So you want to try all the pauses, all the things that go wrong. Yeah, it's taken time, yeah.
No, and, you know, at this, I guess I can say at this point, I somewhat enter the stage performing two or three times, once with my dad. And
yeah, you have. That's been wonderful.
Yeah. And well, one thing that I'm very personally proud of helping organize was the Yiddish open mic that we did in Oxford.
Yes.
That was, I think, the first time that it was in person outside of London, not counting the Sofoch, which we'll get to in a moment, because that, of course, also has its own open mic. But the first time a regular open mic was done outside of London in person, and also, I think, the first student-led open mic. And that was really, really great experience, because I was on the committee of the Jewish Student Society. I was the entertainment rep, which is a position that's usually only held. There's this one big event that the Oxford JSOC throws it two terms a year, which is a jubilation, spelled J-E-W. And for that, you have two entertainment or ENTS reps. And apart from helping with that, I thought that my position there, which I wasn't planning on running in the beginning, but was left unopened, and I thought it would be particularly useful to try with a little bit of the backing of the Jewish Student Society to organize. And that also meant that we managed to get a bit of funding from the Union of Jewish Students, which was about 40 quid for the event, which certainly helped out. It was interesting because a lot of the people that did come who were students were not regulars within the society. They were not people that regularly went to events. And those who did regularly go to events, most of them didn't go to the open mic, even though we did try and advertise it quite a bit. It was just showing that there are some ways in which, and those who did go were actually ended up being very, very happy that they did go. And it was not only students, but also locals, people from the community. And there is a bit of a barrier, like in many places where there are big Jewish student communities and local communities, having an event where people from both sat side by side, as well as people that came specially from London, experienced performers, including you, of course, to help out with that. It was an example of something that can be done in that kind of environment as well, outside of London, which is, of course, you know, Britain in general, everything concentrates around London. The same goes with Jewish life and culture. And it's, I think it certainly serves for me as an inspiration for other work in the future, just with that format that you've got, whether it's 6 minutes or 8 minutes, I'm not too sure. But you can perform basically anything that you want.
Yes.
And the fact that you can have that Yiddish atmosphere of every performance being in Yiddish whilst also being accessible to people who do not know a word of Yiddish.
Yes.
It's really, really the best of both worlds in that way. And I think really the presentation aspect of it was really, really clever for making it move forward in that way.
If I could say that that Oxford event was absolutely wonderful, because it was packed out. I mean, the room was full of people. I had not anticipated that. And it was just marvelous to be in that space. And you did a brilliant job. You can't blush on a podcast. But but it was absolutely super. It was great to have so many young people there. Yeah, it was great. And it was nice that the stalwarts from London were able to come up. And that had actually been I guess I could say a dream to be able to take. The thing is, you're right. We would hope to plant the seed. That was the idea everywhere, that people can do this. It takes a little bit of effort, but it can be done. It doesn't have to be done on a monthly basis. It can be done on a bi-monthly, whatever you want to do. If you ask people to send in the material and you present the Yiddish and the English, it's not an impossible thing to do. And any community anywhere can do this. And, you know, it'd be nice if other people take it up and they use that format. Because as you say, it makes it accessible. And we stumbled on it because we made mistakes to begin with. And then we stumbled upon something which does seem to work. And we use the same format, obviously, online.
And certainly something that can be emulated in this way, and we would hope for. So aside from the, you know, the regular open mics, there is, of course, another big event that is organized outside of London, and that's the Sofvach, the weekend. Yeah. That's organized, as far as I understand, by, or at least in the beginning, was organized by the same people.
Well, we have a Saturday morning conversation group, a Yiddish conversation group that includes somebody from Australia. And we were chatting about the Australian, they have a Sofvach in Australia. They've had one for many years. And I thought, wow, this is absolutely fantastic. What a great idea. Can we possibly do something like that in the UK? So I once upon a time chatted with Helen Beer, who, you know, was the lecturer in Yiddish at UCL. And I thought Helen had come up with that similar sort of idea in the past. And she said, no, but it sounds good. And she was very happy to be supportive. So because we had a great group of people involved in the open mic, that was the basis for forming a group that could think about doing the Yiddish Sofvach. And although we were still in the middle of COVID and we couldn't meet, we planned the first Yiddish Sofvach for the first summer when we were released from the COVID restrictions. And now that we were expanding into that as well, and actually quite a lot of money also goes through the Sofvach, we thought it made sense at that point to be thinking about a charity dedicated to Yiddish activities. And the model for that is Klez North, and Phil Tomlinson and other people who created the Klez North charity, which is for klezmer players. Once a year, they meet in the Peak District in northern England, and it's a fantastic event. People come from all over the world. They get the best klezmer teachers, but they've organized it organizationally as a charity, and we modeled the Yiddish Cafe Trust as a charity on the Klez North model, and the Yiddish Cafe Trust is there to promote activities in Yiddish. So coming under the banner of the Yiddish Cafe Trust is the Yiddish Open Mic and then the Yiddish Sofvach. And that then enables us to be able to ask for donations and to have a home for donations for Yiddish activities and particularly for the Sofvach.
I think that's really an important, you know, I'm thinking of it from the perspective of the organizing, that having that infrastructure and logistics to plan, to think bigger in that way is very, very important step. So what does the Sofvach look like from your perspective, and why does it look that way?
Well, it pretty much looks that way because to a large extent we modeled it on the Australian Sofvach. I asked Michelle from Melbourne to send me copies, examples of what they've done in Melbourne, and they have basically three streams of concurrent activities throughout the weekend. And it enables you to have, you know, something which is like accessible for children as well, and for people whose Yiddish is perhaps not at such a high level, but still you can do all artistic things as well. And then you can have dance stream or something like that, those sorts of activities as well. And you can have lecture type activities in another stream, which are more like sort of lecture based. We wanted to break it up with lots of breaks so people could chat to each other. You know, it's not a conference. It's a place for people to meet other people from all over the UK. And we've had people from all over the world. We've tried to encourage as many young people as possible. And I've always defined young people as under 35. And
fair which enough.
Generationally makes a lot of sense. And we were very lucky. We got two grants. We applied for money and got two grants from American organizations to help us to give bursaries as well in the first years. That was very helpful. And we've consistently had a third of the people there in the under 35 bracket. And I think this year it was even more than a third, actually. Mm-hmm. And the program is not too stuffed with stuff, so that there's enough time for everybody to sing together, to have fun, to play games together if they want to go on walks if they want to, we have people teaching dance or singing sessions. And obviously we have the Friday night and Saturday night activities, and we generally have one or two open mics. The last couple of times we've had two open mics as well, so that people can come along with something to perform if they want to, and they've got an opportunity to do that. So, yeah, it's worked very well. Just had, as you said, the third one. Again, 60 people came, including a few children, which was lovely. And we're already starting to plan. We've got the date for the next one. I think we're even going to book 2026, actually, but we've got the date for 2025, I think.
Very good. Thinking in the future. One thing that also that's pretty... that differentiates it from the open mic in terms of the open mic being very open to anyone who doesn't even speak a word of Yiddish. The Sofoch is Stam Yiddish.
It's only Yiddish. You're not allowed to speak anything else.
No.
You'll be thrown in the duck pond if you speak anything else.
Yes, speaking from experience, that's happened on several occasions. The Yiddish Stasi comes and
not quite
escorts you out of the building. The building itself, and this is something that I also personally sympathize with, the first two years it was held in an old Union Hall near Sheffield, and this year in Birmingham, which also, especially in Sheffield, quite far away from London, it's good to, I'm sure you'll agree with me on this, to get the Londoners up north every now and then.
Well, yeah, being a northerner, yeah, I have no problem with that.
Yeah,
The first 2 years we're at Wortley Hall, which, as you say, is a very interesting union-owned space. And this year, another union-owned space, because it's owned by one of the big teaching unions at Hilt Court, which has, you know, it's a different style of building. It's more modern. And actually, the facilities for the sort of thing we do are probably better than they are at Wortley Hall, though I love the ambience of Wortley Hall, which sort of spreads out and everybody gets lost and can't find each other for 24 hours. But Hills Court, it's a little bit more together. That's a space.
Can't get a taxi anywhere.
No, there was a problem in Sheffield, but Wortley Hall is easier and it's close to Birmingham. And again, it's a lovely space. We didn't have time this year to do many walks. People could have done if they wanted to. It was on the agenda, but I think people were so busy doing other things that they didn't make use of the lovely surroundings. It was wonderful. And this year, every year something different. Last year, we had our first children's program. We had funding for that. This year, we had the wonderful thing of young people brought up in Yiddish-speaking communities speaking Yiddish as they did from the home, as they had from, you know, from growing up, interviewing each other as well and explaining about their upbringings, their home cities. It was fantastic. The whole thing was, I thought it was wonderful.
I think that's particularly important with children, because I strongly sympathize with the idea of bringing up your children speaking Yiddish. Probably not as the only language, but speaking to them in Yiddish, helping that. But I think that makes sense, or it's worthwhile when there are people their age they can speak Yiddish with. Just having a language that you speak with, you know, some adults once a year. I think it's better to have that sort of diversity and certainly visible. And as we sort of mentioned in the beginning with Yiddish this year, particularly, there were quite a few people at the Sofoch who either came from Haredi backgrounds or are still one foot in the Haredi world. And that was very, very interesting to listen to. We heard from Yiddish efforts in Berlin, for example, the Schmus und Wein Yiddish-speaking circle, which is another inspiration for it, as well as what's happening in Vienna with Jung Yiddish Wien, which just finished their own, it wasn't a weekend, it was a Yiddish week. So it was a Woch rather than a Sofoch. And yeah, to touch on that, as we're approaching the hour, there's a lot of different efforts that have been going on regarding Yiddish that are at least visible today, apart from what you have traditionally in America and Australia. Those institutions and events have been going on for quite a while. There are things that are happening now in Germany. France has its own traditional sphere with Centre Medem and Maison de la Culture Yiddish, which used to be one organization. Now there's been developments in Vienna with the setup of Jung Yiddish Wien, which for me is particularly important in terms of having its own physical space, a place where you can walk in and be in a Yiddishist environment off the street, and not just in any place, wherever, but in the heart of the Jewish district in Vienna, and on a Hasidic street as well, or a street of a big Hasidic population. And likewise, of course, we can't forget about the inspiration for that, which was Jung Yiddish Tel Aviv and the work of Mendy Kahan and others. And even in Poland, with the Yiddish Cultural Center, they are just right now finishing up on their summer program, which, of course, is not Yiddish only, but heavily focused on Yiddish and Yiddish culture. And you can go on, talk about Germany. I'm sure there are other places as well that could be mentioned. With the age of the internet and us being a bit more connected through Zoom and used to that because of the pandemic, it really seems like while the questions about Yiddish revival or people speaking more Yiddish being, at least in the secular context, while these ideas certainly have been around for a while, these tools for learning and engagement, communication and art have really been able to bring Yiddishists together around the world in a way that wouldn't have been possible maybe even 10 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. And so the question for me that I've been thinking about a lot in regards to this is the question of what happens now? How does this develop? What's the... is there discussion more of some kind of infrastructure relating to connecting Yiddish efforts? While there are a lot of efforts that go on in terms of having some sort of coordination between them, there are still important barriers when it comes to language, or like Yiddish courses, prices still rather expensive for many people, and they're not generally available in education for children. The Jewish schools do not, in the secular world, do not teach Yiddish as a language. And so this idea, you know, of course, historically, there was the big Chernovitz conference in 1908, which brought around all the Yiddishists and discussed what is the meaning of the language, how should we engage with it, right in that period when a lot of the literature was happening. But these questions around future, really, infrastructure, what about publications? There are efforts. There is, for example, the Olniansky Text Verlag in Sweden, which has been around for a while. But in terms of a publishing house, what about just, you know, sources of information and the newspaper? I know Vorwärts in America. And of course, there is the whole Haredi world that has its own Yiddish sources of information as such. But these are many, many, many different ways in which this sort of organizing takes place and could take place in the future. But for you, what do you think personally of the way of engaging with Yiddish? Do you think that the Yiddishist scene, in whether in Britain or in Europe or around the world, what will it look like? Or do you think it can look like 20 years from now, for example?
It's a lovely question, but I'm not sure I can help you with a rational answer. At the moment, we are trying to get Yiddish theatre off the ground here in London. We've had three very successful events at JW3 in Yiddish theatre evenings, and we've had three workshops, and they've attracted professional actors as well as non-professional, you know, as well as amateurs, and we're looking to get Yiddish theatre off the ground again as another activity within the Yiddish Cafe Trust. Okay, so I think that, you're looking to find ways, and then you suddenly got a whole different group of people who are interested in Yiddish and a way into Yiddish. And this is people who are working in the theatre space. We've got an opera singer, you know, we've got professional actors on the English stage, but have a background in Yiddish, which they heard when they were children. So, you know, there are various ways that people develop their interest in Yiddish. At a European level, I've long thought it would be really nice to have probably a web-based web pages which are contributed in Yiddish from various communities around Europe and Israel and maybe even America or anywhere else if they want to. But I think, you know, just focusing on Europe to begin with, because we do have a common language amongst the various Jewish communities of Europe, which is that in almost every country, there are some people who speak Yiddish. And there's a growing number of young people who speak Yiddish as well, whether it's Poland, Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Netherlands. I mean, there are people there, particularly young people. And a very straightforward, well, it seems in principle straightforward, in practice somebody has to put the effort in, way to unify them and get, it's just to find out what everybody's doing. Just to have like a page for each country where, you know, maybe once a month, somebody writes a few paragraphs and say, look, this is what's happening in Vienna in relation to Yiddish this month, or this is what's happened. And then, you know, somebody writes it for the UK and somebody writes it for France. And that's a start. And then if on the basis of that, you could then do a sort of bring everybody together maybe in a year or so's time after that's got going, the people who form the basis of that, you could bring them together and get them to meet face to face and say, okay, great, so what are we going to do collectively? There are countries which do have money for Yiddish activities. Sweden, obviously, because Yiddish is recognized as an official language in Sweden, and they're luckily the beneficiary of funds from the Swedish government. I'm sure they wouldn't want to give those funds to Poland or the UK, but they can maybe help that sort of enterprise in some way. But also, as you say, France has got organizational strength. Unfortunately, resource is always an issue. People have said to me, well, no, the Forwards already does this. You know, you can write to the Forwards and you can, but the Forwards is a different function. It doesn't really draw different, especially younger members together, I think, telling them what's happening. I don't know if I've got a clue what's going on in Yiddish in Italy. I've just not got a clue, but I'm sure things are happening, all right? Ditto, I don't know what's going on around Poland. It would be so interesting if we knew these things. And that would be a lovely project if anybody had the time and the resource to do that. But yeah, I shall float that out as an idea. We don't have the resource. We're struggling to get Yiddish theatre off the ground. We can't do much else at the moment.
I mean, it's. I think it's good that we're starting off in this, talking about it in at least this capacity. One thing that I would like to do, and I will say this publicly, if I could host a show in Yiddish, I would. I don't feel confident yet with my Yiddish. I know there are others who already do this, but as a subject about similar subject, I thought of the, you know, the logistics behind it. But to have in the form of a podcast, but also publish 3 times or 4 times a day, but a maybe 5-minute news summary of around the world, like the Yiddish news bulletin. And that could, as a cooperative project between people around the world, just, you know, collecting information. And then once every few hours, somebody comes in and says, this is what's happening. And, you know, speak to it in that way.
Well, the Haredi world does this, of course. They have a radio.
They do, yes.
They have a radio program, and they have essentially little podcasty things that go on as a news report. Yiddish 24 is what I'm talking about. They also have sections for stories, and they have religious sections for stories. They have news sections. I mean, it's really interesting. I think that's Satmar. I could be wrong.
I will also say, in terms of languages, you mentioned Sweden. Yiddish is also recognized as a national minority language in Poland.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Because Poland has 9 recognized national minorities, and one of them is Jews as a national minority. And like every national minority has its own language, for Jews, that language is Yiddish. I could get on much more to discuss the situation with Yiddish press and publishing in Poland. The short summary of it is that it is almost completely monopolized by the Towarzystwo Społeczno-Kulturowe Żydów w Polsce, which is the Jewish Social Cultural Association in Poland, which was set up in 1950 as a sort of combination of different Jewish organizations in Stalinist Poland. And because Dossier de Shavuot once every 2 months, I believe, and they have a Polish section at the front and a Yiddish section of a few translated articles at the back, that is the justification for the Polish government of saying it takes care of its national minorities in terms of publishing in their languages as well. A lot of work to do regarding that. I think in a previous episode, I think this was with one of our Making Mentions collaborations, we spoke about the situation with Nayech Falas, which was a Yiddish radio program that ran on Polish state radio about 10, 15 years ago. So I'll leave it at that. But just as a final question, if we're already talking about Yiddish in terms of being recognized as a Jewish language in Poland, this can be a final point. And we've touched on this already a few times today. But of course, when discussing issues on Yiddish, some people, some claims that I've heard, especially in more left-wing Jewish spaces, there is the idea that Yiddish is Ashkenormative, or that it contributes to the perception of Ashkenazi Jewish culture as the dominant cultural identity of Jews. While I understand this criticism, I also sometimes feel frustrated that it comes from people whose main Jewish identity is connected around opposing whatever the Israeli government and state are doing. And their Jewish identity is almost reduced to that. So when people actually do something in Yiddish, the question of why aren't you doing this thing in other Jewish languages comes off to me. Yeah, it comes off to me as a little bit of just a snide, somewhat bad faith comment, or even questions about like, how is Yiddish going to end Israeli apartheid, etc. We could get into more on the subject of how the fact of Yiddish being treated as a language in and of itself challenges some of the core ideas behind at least what is today modernly understood as modern Jewish nationalism. But I wanted almost to ask you in terms of what efforts do you think either are done or can be done to help with the development of other Jewish languages? Because unlike Yiddish, which has at least a somewhat strong living base among Haredi speakers, Ladino doesn't have it, at least not in the same sort of isolationist base that allows for the language to be maintained without a state institute connecting towards it. And this is something that Eyal, someone from a Jewish student from Turkey, who we had about 20 episodes ago last year, spoke about, that Ladino institutions and ways of learning the language and speaking it on a regular basis are in a much more difficult situation than even Yiddish is. So do you think that this is something that we should focus on more? And if so, have there already been efforts that you know about in at least the British spaces? And what other ways do you think that we could help our other Jewish diasporic communities connect with their languages in that way?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Of course, Yiddish struggles for resource in any sense. I tried to explain how difficult it is to get resources to do anything. We, unlike Vienna, we don't have a center. We don't have an address for Yiddish at the moment in any sense within the UK. It would be nice to just have an address, really. We have a web space, but we don't have an address. But in terms of Ladino, and I was in Istanbul a few years ago at the Jewish Community Center, they were lamenting the fact that young people were turning their backs on Ladino, and how sad this was, that they couldn't see the value in it. But recently, as you've just said, I've heard from people that there's a resurgence of interest in Ladino, which is absolutely fantastic. And as I think I said before, I think most people with an interest in Yiddish who've come to the language, maybe it's easier if you come to the language not as your native spoken language, but you come to learn it, you realize the value of all Jewish languages. And yeah, that's definitely something that one should try to support. And if Ladino speakers are, as they organize themselves and try and do stuff, it would be wonderful to think that maybe we could do things together if possible. I don't know the cultural depth in terms of literature of some of the other Jewish languages. And it's the cultural depth in terms of literature of Yiddish which makes it, I suppose, feel as if it has a greater weight. Although the numbers of people, and of course, as you said, the Hasidic, Haredi communities, there's a lot of people speaking Yiddish there. And maybe Ladino doesn't have that large number of people. But the number of secular Yiddish speakers might well be about the same as the number. I don't know how many Ladino speakers there are, but, you know, we probably both number in the thousands around the world of secular Yiddish speakers. So, but the in the Haredim, of course, it's a different issue. So I'm not sure I'm addressing your question in the way you phrased it, except that I think we want to applaud and support and do whatever we can with any other Jewish languages. They're all very important. That's the best we can try to do.
Yeah, certainly. I think, yeah, just as a reminder, when we spoke to Yana Naftalieva as the president of the World Union of Jewish Students, we mentioned the situation with Juhuri and the community in Moscow, that spoke it as a language, and the same sort of situation about people who are interested in it and people who do not know of it as a possibility or it not being advertised in that way. When I hear that people say that, you know, why learn Yiddish or people are not interested in it, I think of it from the perspective of the first time I started talking a bit more about Yiddish in the Jewish student community in Warwick, which is where I was for my first degree. And within the span of, you know, a few weeks, I knew at least 6 or 7 people that said that they would like to learn Yiddish, at least to some extent. And that being, and just by also explaining a little bit what it is and having that idea and what sort of resources are there, what sort of world does it open up for you, the community that already exists of Yiddish secular speakers in Britain. And one thing that also, and I'll sort of finish this in terms of our great schemes of Yiddish world domination, but one idea that I had at the time was to instruct the Union of Jewish Students to conduct a survey, and it could be framed as a survey of Jewish languages in general. Because to be fair, Hebrew is not also somehow strongly promoted in a way that ideological Zionism might indicate of some people. It's not the case that for Jewish students, Hebrew education is particularly easy, especially for those who do not go through at least some basic level at a Jewish primary and secondary school. But just the idea of having a survey that indicates which of these languages would you be interested in learning and to what extent? Is it just a question of having, you know, just knowing the basics of it or a little bit more or fluent conversation, and just having that be filled out by Jewish students? And whether it's the case that there are 50 people that say they want to speak Yiddish, although I think that number could easily count in the low hundreds, that could be a tool for us to use in the future, saying, this is what we want, this is what we wish the resources of our community to be used for, which currently they are not, from my end. But Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you regarding this, as always. If there's anything else that we haven't touched on that you would like to mention still or shout out, any initiatives or places where people should look to learn more about the Open Mic, the Sofoch, the Trust, anything, please feel free to use this as your space.
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't want to make long advertisements. The Yiddish Cafe Trust has a website, and a lot of stuff we do is on the website. The Yiddish Open Mic Cafe is also on Facebook. And I think at some point we'll have the Yiddish theatre activities. More of them will go on to the Yiddish Cafe Trust website as well. Those are places, or people can write to me direct if they want. trust@yiddishcafe.com is the email address that comes direct to me, but Yiddish Cafe Trust has got a number of email addresses on the website. Thanks very much, Zach. It's been a really interesting conversation. There's so many areas we could have gone into, we'd never chance to. I will just finish with one slightly amusing anecdote. A lot of people organised the Yiddish Sofoch, as you know. One of them, Ilan Kalema. We both went to Limud, the last Limud, you know, the big one in Birmingham. And Ilan put into the programme that he was going to spend three sessions at Limud just reading Yiddish stories. No compromise given for translation, right? And I thought, I went along to them. I thought, nobody is going to come to this at Limud. This is not a space. We do have bits and pieces in Yiddish in Limud. Nobody's going to come to this. And 12 people turned up to read Shalom Aleichem. And I could not believe it. And they focused on it. And a lot of them actually did have Yiddish in the background. So it is interesting. Your survey of what Jewish students would be interested in. You know, we might find a lot of things we didn't realize. And some of the actors, professional English stage actors who've come along to the Yiddish theatre workshops, the three we've had, they have Yiddish in the background. They had their grandparents speaking it, and they know Yiddish from when they were very young. It's amazing what turns up. You just don't know.
A schönen Dank und Schkoi. Okay.
Großen Dank.
Sei gesund.
Halt.
Brüder und Schwester von Arbeit und Neut, alle, was seinen, zu seht und zu spreit, zusammen, die von sie ist greit, sie flattert von Zorn, von Blut ist sie reut, a Schwue, a Fleb und Teut. Immer und a Schwue von Tränen, mir schwören. Mir schwören a Treiheit und Grenzen zum Bund, nur erkennbar freien, die Sklaven sind, die von die Reute ist hoch und breit, sie flattert von Zorn, von Blut ist sie reut. A Schwue, a Fleb und Teut. Himmel und Erd, wenn uns eus Herren, ey, das wird sein, die lichtige Stern. A Schwue vom Blut und a Schwue von Tränen, mir schwören. Und a Schwue von Tränen, mir schwören.